Okay, Ben, I want to complete Karl Marx's work. Do you have any idea on how we could do that based on what we said for 10 hours?
Well, I think completing Karl Marx's work is the labor of the whole of humanity, working out the repercussions of what he said. Because Karl Marx left the realm of philosophy into a realm where actual practice had to decide what was right or wrong. And this seems to be a big thing for people to take on board. They seem to like philosophy as some kind of consumer option, some box you tick in which you know where you are. But he destroyed all that. He made you realize you could think what you think because of your social being, which allows certain things. So if you are dissatisfied with the things you're thinking, you have to change your social being. And you can't do that except in concert with other people. And therefore it requires collective action. But a kind of collective action which is very, very different from what we know as politics, which is a thin skin of some people talking that we all have to suffer. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I get the idea that Marx advocated an ad hoc ongoing struggle. Ad hoc, you know, you improvise in response to the effects you create.
Yeah, it's not about building. It's not about building a particular machine or a particular visible church or political party or anything like that. And therefore, it needs to be respond to events. But one of my favorite quotations from Karl Marx, he said in a letter to somebody I've forgotten. And which he said, the point is not to tell people to drop what they're doing and follow our slogans. It's to understand why they're in conflict and to explain to them why. And that idea of explanation, of your contribution being not replacing what people do, which has always seemed to me what cults do or religions or those kind of movements which just say drop everything and do some weird practice. It's about understanding where people already are, but seeking to understand why people are in conflict or what the underlying pressures are that lead people into conflict.
Great, Ben, you're stopping.
I remember who it was for. It was for Arno Brook. No, I've forgotten again. Okay, it was on on the tip of my memory stick and then it dipped underneath again. Memory is interesting because it comes up and goes down, but the things that you really, really influence you, you don't remember in the kind of detail that the pedantry of the world would like. I had a lot of problems when my book on Zappa was first published, and I was accused of inaccuracy, and I had made a lot of slips, but I found I made all the slips where the writing was best, and I was really at ease with my material, and I wasn't going and looking it up. I was doing it from memory. And where it gets digested into memory, there are substitutions made and actual errors made in terms of the literal text. But I think that's where you're understanding the real drift of what somebody is saying. Arno, oh, it's gone again. But does it really matter? I mean, it's the idea that matters, isn't it? And that idea of actuality being in a ferment and a conflict, and the interesting thing to do is not to intervene by saying stop all that and come and do something else, as if people could choose in that abrupt a way, but of understanding what actually is the conflict and maybe finding some way of understanding it that could flip people out of a conflict they don't need to be into some new realm because they've understood what the pressures were. So it is an enlightenment idea. It's the idea that understanding can actually help things. An idea which has been under attack for the last 30 years.
Well, 3 minutes ago I was praising you for stopping and only speaking for a minute, but then I had to wait, so I take it back. But you have stopped, so let me try to respond to some of the things you said. What you were saying about the ad hoc nature of the Marx Revolution, how many people do you encounter in London understand that?
About 5.5.
Right. So you're pretty marginalized. Tony Blair didn't understand it, right?
nor Gordon Brown, nor any of those sort of people. But those people aren't where they are because of the ideas they're trying to put together. They're there as symptoms of an entire system and articulating various needs of various layers. What interests me is speaking the truth about a system, and you'll find that when people speak the truth, it's generally among, there are very few people who are intimate with them, that intimacy is a rare thing. And I'm not sure that anyone really can be intimate with more than 5.5 people. And I'm sort of reflecting a famous comment of Captain Beefheart's that, and then I won't say it right, but there are
only 40 people in the world.
There are only
five are hamburgers.
Yeah, well, was it 5 real people in the world and 2 of them are hamburgers?
No, there's 40 people in the world.
All right.
And 5 of them are hamburgers.
Well, in the digestive juices of my mismemory, I converted it into something a bit more interesting, which is that I think the amount of people we can really be intimately honest with are very few. And that is the only basis for a true human interaction. And that the relationship between one person and millions of followers or listeners is in its nature corrupt, and that I'm looking for some kind of system of communication that would allow for this intimacy to actually take over and come into control. And I think that's what Lenin meant by Soviets, by workers' councils, where what rules is actually the people you know best, that you work with every week democratically or every day democratically. Those are the people you trust, and it's that kind of intimate understanding that should be in charge, instead of an alienated system that can only get through what it needs via violence.
Okay, in reference to you making mistakes in your best writing in your Zappa book, that reminds me of McLuhan saying that the more involved you are, the less you know. And it's that involving aspect, which is tactile, that you're referring to in my reference point. The other thing is that we look around and there's a trillion news groups with 5 or 12 or more people. So technologically, we have people working on an intimate level you're talking about, but that certainly isn't what you think is revolutionary. That
is fragmenting.
But how can we go from the five circle of five that are working pretty cohesively together and translate into a bigger level? Is there no big level to translate it into? Are we
absolutely trying to do that? I think there is. I think when the students and workers of Paris took over the center of the city in May 1968 and sent a telegram to Mao saying, and don't think we're on your side either, shaking your shoes, you state capitalist bureaucrats, you got a moment at which that kind of clarity and honesty about what things actually are had taken power in a first world country. So that dropping of illusions, of dropping of the usual understandings which keep people in separated nations and separated sectarian politics, those moments are possible, and that is what I would call revolution. So yes, Bob, I want to start a revolution, but having looked at history, I recognize that revolutions are definite moments of which the moment of honesty and truth that I'm talking about can surface, and that requires the involvement of a lot of people. But these aren't all people conceived of in the Coca-Cola or electioneering sense, who are people merely buying something or voting, putting a cross somewhere. These are people actively changing what they are, and this is what I think we're pursuing, which is that the 60s should not be represented by a few key figures, Che Guevara or Frank Zappa or Kennedy or whoever you choose, Marshall McLuhan, or even our favorite people, but we're tracking ideas that were made possible by the ferment of a lot of people moving at the same time.
What's interesting is that Marshall McLuhan agreed with the ad hoc approach to what was going on. So if that was Marx, then he was Marxist in strategy too. Other point was,
ad hoc, maybe I should... listeners who may not know Latin. I mean, ad hoc means to the moment, to this particular point, isn't it?
Yeah, you're responding to the needs and wants of the present, and you're not holding to a strategy that's ironclad, and you have to adapt to it. New things happen every day, and you just respond. It's like winging it, improvising, knowing that there are unforeseen effects of what you did yesterday.
And ad hoc. Derek Bailey, the progenitor of the progenitator, is that a real word? The progenitor, the godfather of
the progenitor.
The progenitor, that's the correct word. Of free improvisation, talked about what he did as improvisation, like an improvised shelter. It's not a house, it's something you put up suddenly in a forest when you need it. And ad hoc was another term used to describe these kind of musical encounters. And that's precisely what I'm interested in. And in the Marxist area, they would call that ideology critique, because for them, ideologies are your ironclad set of principles, your undeviating beliefs. And what Marxism is meant to be doing is an ideology critique. We're against ideologies because we believe in the continual flow of the dialectic, which means discussion, which means debate. And if people can't reply to you live, I always suspect that there's some dishonesty on board, some need to hide something. The politicians who completely collapse if a heckler gets up and shouts something, that need everything engineered and have to plant questions and create a spectacle of what they are, that's an insecurity born of the fact that they know they're lying. Whereas,
exactly,
yeah, the kind of freedom we're talking about has nothing left to lose.
Right. So ad hoc, dialectics is ad hoc.
Yeah, it has to be. There's nothing. Dialectics and improvisation and ad hoc are all terms for the same thing.
Yeah. Now, what you remind me of is you're an Eskimo, Ben. I could cite other Aboriginal cultures, but you're describing life in a small little group, a primitive, you know, not much technology, and they stay in touch with each other, and they ad hoc it. They don't know what the weather's going to do. And when you go into your flip-out scene that happened in 82, I don't know if, I have not read the essay you've done on it, but you told me about it, and it was triggered partly by the experience you had with a small group in France, and it reminded me of, you know, Eskimos. I don't know what they do now. I don't know if there are any Eskimos, but it's legendary that they would occasionally swap their wives and have parties and just let all the social boundaries go. You had that kind of experience in 82, I think. And if I want to tag that on to the mythology or the legends or the archaeological data of the Eskimos, you are advocating an Eskimo sensibility. That is your ideal. You're looking for that. You're looking for a small group of people that you can interact with and then welcome new members if they're capable. But am I off on saying this?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not quite sure where I am on this, because in one way I'm advocating it. In another way, I'm pointing out that this already is actual existence, that the social basis of people's sanity is the 5.5 people they can really communicate. The half, by the way, is very important, because it's the person you're still working on that you haven't broken through to yet, or the person you're losing. So even this thing is dynamic and changing. You don't just like have your five and then it's set for all time. There's an element of doubt and confusion. There is the half person, and you're never quite sure which of your 5.5 is the half. So that's
right.
That's moving as well.
When I showed up at your place a year ago in April, I was the half person brought in to meet your core friends, because they came and you had a party there, and we even brought in Alan Mutton, who was an old friend. So that I experienced what you're talking about, right?
Now, yes, you experienced it. But when I say, it's interesting because I need a new word, because when you say advocate, it's as if I'm saying nobody's doing it like this, they ought to be doing it like this. I don't really agree with ought. I want to show people what they're already doing. And I think people already are in the situation in which they can only honestly listen and talk to far fewer people than they think they're doing. So it's more bringing this fact to consciousness to allow people to admit that the spectacular reaches of economics and media that we're told about how somebody releases an album, all these million people consume it, understand that this is actually a form of non-communication, that we have all the possibilities for networking these real communications, but we're frozen because of the need to maximize capital return into media and political situations which are doing the opposite. So it's there, it's present, it's possible, but it is suppressed, and that's why you need revolution.
Yeah, the I wouldn't say advocate, I would say this Eskimo sensibility is what you throw at those you criticize. You try to remind them of that, that that's the core beauty of experience. That's, I guess that's what I meant by advocate, that you hold this up to the pomos and all people you don't like, and it is your ideal, your reminder. Can you agree with that?
Yeah, and I find it really interesting you're talking about Eskimos, because when I went to an event organized by Les Fils de l'Invention, the chapter of Frank Zappa fans in Paris, I bought a book called Économie Eskimo by Paco Thielemont. It's subtitled Le Rêve de Zappa. So it's Eskimo Economics, The Dream of Zappa. And it's published by Repercussion in 2005. And Paco gave a talk when he was there, and it explores exactly the argument that you're saying.
Oh, very interesting. So you've mentioned this title to me.
Yeah.
But I haven't read it.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we're talking about is objective, because it's popping up in different areas, which brings me, round to thinking of something we were talking about before we put on the mics, as it were, off stage. How do we describe the brief conversations we have in Skype before we put on the hijack recorder?
It's a preamble where we talk about what we're really excited about. This is a different situation.
We're aware of.
We try to carry that over, but we often get our best stuff off mic.
Yeah.
Because we don't have to worry about censorship or about what we're saying or, I don't know, something. Not that we're the type of person who worries, but I think it's too personal what we do off mic.
Yeah, I don't think it would be pleasant to broadcast that. There's a certain, what Freud called the superego, loaded in when you think of what an audience is. It creates a tension in your brain. You write very differently if you're asked by a local newspaper to when you're asked by an art journal, because what you do when you write is that you imagine what the audience is, and it's not really so different for what we do, that when we're talking to each other, it becomes
Five and a half mode. See, you drop the five and a half mode when you leave the small scale that the Eskimo lives in, when you get into the media audiences, which is McLuhan's point.
Certainly, and it doesn't mean that I say that one should have no relationship with media. I mean, people will find what I'm arguing rather paradoxical, because here I only believe in real communication between five people, and I love the work of Frank Zappa. But the reason I love the work of Frank Zappa is that it was deliberately designed to block all the bad stuff that happens when people make a mistake and buy a Beatles record and think they can kiss the photograph. One of the things he made fun of in bad commercial pop rock was the big kissable photograph on the cover, because what you've done then is you've allowed somebody to buy a record thinking that they can buy a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and he was merciless about that and made records which are disgusting to kiss. You couldn't kiss them. They would be like kissing a barbed wire sandwich. I mean, they're hostile to the commodity sense that people might have of something of that glamour. That it destroys it. So what I'm saying is that I believe in this truth between five people. I don't mind the idea of communicating with tens of thousands. I'd love to do it, but I'm going to do it in a way which makes them understand that what they're hearing from me is not the closeness of a friend. I'm not going to give them a substitute for one of those five friends. I'm going to give them something completely different that is designed to go out into the media almost as a hostile countervirus. to the false intimacy which is being perpetrated. I mean, Philip K. Dick did it, a beautiful satire of this, of somebody going around in a satellite giving people advice in a kind of homely what do you call it in America, you know, like a guy on a sitting on a tractor chewing a straw and talking to you, and he perfectly predicted Ronnie Reagan's whole performance. Was it Ronnie Reagan? One of your old presidents, anyway.
Yes, no, he did. But McLuhan is the one who predicted Reagan would become a president, and a great president, ironically great, but great. He predicted that in 76, right when no one was taking Reagan seriously. Dick minded, McLuhan predicted, because he said Reagan was able to do the presidential role because as an actor he could merge with the role. And McLuhan was pointing out how the presidency was just a role in the global theater, and you had to have no personal conscience about it to be a good president. And then Reagan did that. He became known as a great communicator, even though he was ridiculous, you know, if you have some kind of literate sensibility. You didn't think Reagan was a great communicator. Who knows what they meant when... Well, I know what they meant, but I can understand people not understanding why they said Reagan was a great communicator, you know? The reason Zappa, I thought it was very interesting, he couldn't answer Bob Marshall's question about who are the brain police. He said, this is in 1988, he was still working on it, because even though Zappa was making fun of the kissable photos, he knew that it was real. It was something virtual, but it was real. The brain took it, and he was caught in between that, like McLuhan was. They were both raising the question, how much of this 40,000 messages a month that these kids instant message, can we deny that not real? It's not intimate?
Yeah, I mean, it's real and it's having an effect. I mean, the question would be whether that effect is desirable or not, and you've got to take a stand on it, because this is really goes back to my, am I advocating or describing the paradox that we're all involved in is between being able to delineate what's there, and then there's also what we think of it. Now, sociologists have a very easy way of describing this, and they describe it as having a what you try and do is withdraw fact from value, that you try and objectively map things, and that you don't evaluate, that you remove that from you take out the subjective side. And it was Adorno who pointed out that actually fact without value is meaningless, because which facts do you want to look at? That without a human motivation and without bringing to consciousness your own motivation in doing anything, you're actually not being scientific, you're actually repressing part of what's there. So you're actually hiding a fact when you don't have values, when you don't judge, when you don't take a position. And I don't think it's possible to describe what's happening in the world without confessing your own particular point of view and your own assessment of what's going on. And the people who do that are simply repressing it.
The key question in Finnegan's Wake is the encounter in the park where HCE meets the CAD and wants to know what time it is. Zappa, in an interview, was asked, well, he actually had himself, this was done for New Music in Toronto, the City TV show, City TV local Moses Neimer station, where Zappa is a funny journalist, interviewed himself, and the journalist asked him, what do you really want to know? And Zappa looks off the side and goes, what time is it? So I ask you, Ben, time, Finney's Wake, time, Zappa, what is time to you? Is there time?
What has this got to do with the standoff between facts and value that I was talking about? We seem to have jumped into time, and I'm not sure why. I mean, are you worried that we've gone on for too long, or...
No, it's a fact. Is time a fact or a value? Because, you know, you're having a good time and time goes by real fast. You're having a bad time, there's no time. I mean, it takes a lot of time if you're having a crummy time. I'm taking the fact of time
Well, the facts of time, it's very easy to split things back into subjective and objective, as everybody knows. You know, it seemed to you it was a long time. I looked at my clock, actually it wasn't. And everybody believes that their clocks are objective time, are the truth, because they believe objectivity is truth and subjectivity is untruth. And maybe they have a little place called religion or personal beliefs in which you're allowed to have a little bit of subjectivity, but actually it's powerless and can be sidelined. But this objectivity we're talking about, this time, is the victory of a particular mode of production. It's not an accident that even when they change the wording for it, you know, it used to be you used to say AD, Anno Domini, for the year of our Lord. They've changed that. It's something a bit more objective about the Christian era now, the letters you put after a date. We're still all tied, dating everything, date stamping it. They're doing this in China when they do production, to a Christian calendar, and that is to do with the roots of the historical roots of capitalism coming out of England and the Netherlands and Protestant Europe. With Catholic Europe following quite close behind. And so this phenomenon of capitalism has Christian roots, and therefore it's stamping everything with a date, which, if you look at in scientific terms, is bizarre. I mean, why the birth of a particular Jewish rebel against the Romans in a particular country? Why has this become the rational, the scientific way in which we're going to like understand everything and understand time?
So because he showed up at the time of the phonetic alphabet getting locked in with papyrus. That was McLuhan's point. And then the printing press...
Sorry, the phonetic alphabet getting locked in with the...
With the Roman Empire.
Did you say Jesus. The papyrus?
Yeah, at the time of the Roman Empire, time of Jesus' life... The phonetic alphabet was starting to be locked down as a medium over a vast stretch of space. And so Jesus was the one who was the philosopher who got locked into that, and that became the dominant medium, survived the Dark Ages. And then the printing press, which is...
Well, hang on. Let's keep with... Can we keep with Jesus and just unpack what you're saying? Can I say it back in a way I'd understand it, which is the primary method of the spread of Christianity was the book called the Bible. Is that why you're...
Yeah,
so once it's written down, so that form of power needs a start date, needs a figure, and therefore it's at that time that that kind of particular political power can be built. I mean, it's modelled quite closely on Plato writing down the dialogues of Socrates, isn't it? Because Plato wrote down what Socrates said. There are arguments that in his early works he reflects the true Socrates, who was more interested in wild sex and intellectual abandon and vast amounts of wine drinking.
He's an ad hoc Eskimo.
And Plato later sort of starts ghostwriting the Socrates into all the things that he thinks. I mean, he's a bit of a Habermas after Adorno, you know, a kind of really depressing right-wing person adopting the mantle of the exciting person. But that model of you have the person who really changes everything, who just keeps talking, and then the scribe who comes along and turns it into a system... That's what you have with Jesus. I mean, it's St. Paul who writes down what he says, and St. Paul is actually a Platonist and is using a lot of Plato's ideas. So, you see, some of the light I'd like to cast on McLuhan, because he makes quite a useful distinction between periods and says, you know, the book age and maybe the manuscript age and then the printing press age and then the electronic age. But I'd like to cast some other dynamics over that, shed some coloured lights on these divisions, because this process of the person who is communicating with the five people, or Jesus took it up to 12 with the disciples, but I'm talking about a small number of people you can be intimate and honest with, the person who turns that into a system and can dominate, because you can actually copy this Bible again and again and again and build a church and you duplicate it everywhere. I mean, you go to a church in, you know, kind of the north of England, it's not that different from a church in Spain or, you know, in other parts of the post-Roman Christian world. It has the same shape and, you know, functional. I mean, they've developed a way of dealing, but which also unites the society and allows you to have a larger concept, and so you can have the Pope at the top of it. Now, this difference between the creative oral person and what can happen to their theories once it's turned into a system seems to me to float above these divisions. It seems to carry on and happen again and again. And for example, the political party I've been most involved in Britain as the Socialist Workers' Party, it's very much founded on the very oral skills of someone called Tony Cliff, who's now died, who was his parents were Jews who went to Palestine. He looked around and saw that the Palestinian kids didn't have shoes, but they had shoes. Why? He wanted to find out. He became a socialist and a rebel against his background. And Cliff was an amazing live orator. He had a terrible accent. I mean, it was hard to hear what he said, but he was electrifying. And it was his live speaking that inspired everybody. But this congealed into a set of principles about interpretation of history and all the rest of it, which the party has got quite stiff with since his death, and we're having a lot of problems reinvigorating it and finding our way back to this oral truth. Now, that tension and how you are celebrating us, bringing things back to talking and kind of slightly making fun of the people taking notes and turning what we're saying back into something academic or literary, it seems like a thing which is outside these explanatory eras of production of media that McLuhan analysed. Do you think they are? Do you think this dialectic is forever, that the spirit is always there and critical, and all the machineries may change, but you know, is that what you believe?
No, and I wasn't sure what you meant. I don't know what you're talking about. Let me just think. And for anybody who's taking notes, I'm all for it. I don't have any preference for any medium. I am trying to show how the interplay of the media cancels all of them out today.
But what about, you know, off mic when we were talking about, you know, we were joking about maybe we're the, like, jamming and we're able to solo, and people who write it down are the lame people who come and analyse what we do afterwards, and it's like the people who try and transcribe Charlie Parker's solos. I mean, maybe we should talk about the particular to argue about that idea. I mean,
you know, that's good. The thing is that I was joking about how one might find it hard to figure out what we are getting at if you take notes on us. And I think we improvise. I have no idea. We've created, for me, very interesting 10 hours, now into the 11th hour. But I have not got you on board on completing the Marx Revolution. We just talk. Oh. And I'm trying to get... I mean, you have pointed out, you realize it's a bit of a McLuhan there. I mean, this dialectic between the spoken, I don't put any value on the spoken over the eye. I just notice what the eye does. The eye media creates bureaucracy. But today, with the decentralized magical digital media, we can be little Eskimo groups all over the place, millions of us, and I'm trying to figure out if there's any place, any focus point where we can say, this, we pull that lever, then we break through and we get rid of capital. That's what I'm trying to do here, trying to stimulate or create a revolution, recognizing the media laws. Mm-hmm. That Jesus lucked out. He showed up right when the papyrus was getting nailed. And if it wasn't for the Irish monks, according to urban legend, he would have been lost. But they kept the manuscript culture mm-hmm. going until 1000 AD, or whatever they call it, mm-hmm. the Common Era, where the monks got more organized, set up the clock and mechanism, and started the assembly line in their monasteries. And then the printing press came along from China. And then that locked in the Western bureaucracy. They've had 100 years of problems since the electric age came in, and now the digital. How can we not focus so much on the media and get to Tony Cliff's inspiration? I'm trying to inspire billions of people to get on my agenda, but if they push me, I'm not sure what we have in common. I don't mean you and me. I mean the millions who love me. I don't know what we have in common other than they like my show. And I don't want to be limited to that. That's what Joyce was about, McLuhan was about, Karl Marx was about, and Zappa was about. Maybe even Beefheart. They did not want to be locked in. I remember in the L.A. Free Press interview in August 69, if you want to look it up, Zappa hears about a bunch of kids or young people took over a small town in California in the the heyday of the student, or whatever you call it, the activism of post-68. And he says, that's the real story. Forget about interviewing me. Go talk about those kids. Now, that, see, he did not want to be a leader in any sense, even though he was forced to run for president. He was always wrestling with this fucking, this dilemma, you know, of what communication is today.
Yeah.
Where's the revolution? I mean, where would Karl Marx, if he showed up today, be outraged at what was done in his name? Jesus would be.
Well, of course he would be, but he would be, but he's got to take that has to be dealt with as part of continuing being interested in his ideas. You can't not do that just insisting, well, we go back to the original and then it's fine. It always irritated me with arguing with Christians. They always say, when I say, well, Christians did this, oh, well, that's not us, you know, if you go back to the original. And it kind of seemed, well, why should all this bad stuff be done? I mean, it's very interesting why the Russian so-called Soviet system, you know, could clothe itself in Marxism. That's part of the history of what it is, and why it's significantly different from Nazism, and just jamming them all together as totalitarianism never understands the structural differences between the two different societies that arose.
Structural differences. Now, McLuhan made cartoons out of those structural differences and called them media dynamics. So why don't we establish what the structural differences are for our situation and what we're trying to do in these dialogues? Mm. What are the structural differences? That's another way. That's materialist conditions.
Well, one of the things, you see, I was thinking about time and media, and I wouldn't like, I mean, I was referring to directness and honesty and speaking off the cuff to people as being a moment of criticism of the bureaucracy and so on, but I wouldn't like to have to boil everything into that, because our talks actually lock the listener into time. That one of the good things about looking at a printed text is that you can skip paragraphs, you can go back, you can read it again. You aren't simply having to repeat the time flow of the original discussion. And that's a problem with spoken word. Spoken word, even on received digitally, is not necessarily superior to print, although it depends where you're doing it. You can listen to it while you're doing a chore in the house. You can listen to it while driving a car. You know, there are various moments in which you can slide in. I'm sorry to have suddenly banalized our grand concepts, but this is the concrete.
You're on the right track.
I mean, this is...
this is good what you're saying. Useful.
I mean, I wanted to get into audio as soon as I heard that that American girls were downloading BBC talks onto their iPods because of all those sexy British accents. And I was thinking, yeah, that's what I'd like to do.
And why did you want to do that? And what are you trying to achieve by that?
The satisfaction of thinking that they might like what I'm saying. They might, you know, they might have, it might create some kind of dialogue or...
they might like what you're saying.
Yeah.
Let's say they did like it. Then you'd be on Johnny Carson or with Jay Leno or something, and then you'd be on Larry King. And where would that go?
Well, I probably
be allowed on Al Jazeera.
Yeah. Well, my appearances then would be, I suppose, rather like Marshall McLuhan's in his heyday, where it creates a kind of embarrassing media situation.
Yeah.
So
you went on this impulse. You had this idea. Oh, wow! Great. I want them like, but if you actually sit back and use your critical dialectical analysis, you say, well, why would I want to do that? But you don't stop yourself completely. You go,
well, no, because you can't stop yourself, because you've got an id which wants to expand your base, isn't it? I mean, it wants to get through, and that's an energy, and you have to ride it. I mean, this is why I appreciate rock and roll as against art rock, I suppose. That I don't trust bands that say, well, we don't want a lot of success, we just want to reach a few people. You know, I just think liars, you know.
And they just want to be Eskimos.
Yeah. But this doesn't mean that I love the people who are successful, because, and this again goes back to why I keep thinking about Zappa as a model. I mean, the people in The Fall said it. I don't know whether you've come across The Fall.
Yes, I'm aware of them. They used to be on CKLN when I was there.
Manchester band. Yeah. You have a name for integrity and not selling out, and he keeps changing his band and being awkward and drunk in the wrong places, and you know, so he's loved by the people who hate success. But he did say in an interview, well, what we'd like is success Zappa style, you know, success without compromise, or but this lack of compromise, people think they know what that means. Well, exactly what does it mean? What do you do to not compromise? And I think what it is always creating situations where you become more aware of what the processes are that you're using. And so most of the people who the rock bands and the rap bands who follow their lusts and their proclivities don't seem able to reflect on what's happening and be amusing about it. They take it so seriously they end up doing ads for shoes, which I don't find inspiring. I mean, it's maximizing their earning potential, but it seems to me a boring place to end up. So there's some sort of, and I'm hoping you'll help me articulate this, because these are kind of ideas I half have that I haven't really turned into defensible positions yet.
No, they're very important questions and statements. The your value at this point is, covered a bunch of things. Sometimes I don't know which one to go at. Okay, so you admit you don't know at different points. You don't like people who won't admit they don't know what they're doing when pressed on other areas that they're involved in but don't recognize it. That's another way of becoming aware. Becoming aware is canceling what you think you know or in admitting it. That's what you like to experience. And you can do more of that on a small scale with a few people. You got time to talk about your doubts in that. But you went on with Iranian TV, you've got to look certain. Uh-huh. You're not allowed to make yourself a, you know, if I went on Iranian TV, I'd explain the whole media they're in and go into and raise the I don't know level to as fast as possible. They wouldn't like that. Maybe they like it for once, but then they wouldn't invite me back. You see, Ben, how can you take the intimate level and watch it be appropriated by technology, what I call the Android meme, which makes it everybody's little Eskimo reality and the little chat groups, and yet, and this is great, this could be considered great. I'm not even sure. You say, we need to talk about music more. How do we talk about music? What do you want to talk about?
About music. I want to talk about specific media occasions or products which we've found vibrate with a particular element that we're interested in. I'm seeking greater articulacy through talking about a common object. That's
right,
really
okay.
What it is.
I this might relate to that. I was thinking a couple minutes ago how I love Zappa's concerts in the 80s. He definitely had improved and was making great music. They were the best things that ever happened in human history as far as I was experiencing when I was there live in concert and listening to him. But I noticed when he got on TV, he started to have a pot belly. He was not really on to commenting on things. He was becoming passive, not as sharp. Now, people would say, oh, he got older and he got wiser. No rebel. But there was a split going on that he was getting a little too relaxed compared to what he could do back in the 70s, or it seemed. And that was an interesting point. Now, that's a thought I'm getting, that I got when I think of Frank, how great his music was, and yet he wasn't too good on when he was interviewed on radios. Occasionally he was, but he started to become lazy to me in how he spoke.
Well, I think he got he went into the realm of accepting the flattery that he was a great composer and that music was his life. The whole music is the best thing. Whereas in the earlier era, he didn't seem to give you that option. He seemed to be an attack upon everything and everybody. And he was using, because music was like that then. I mean, music wasn't known as music. It was a new movement. It was being hairy. It was doing all these sorts of things. It was relating to people in a different way.
Yeah, and I actually, he could he didn't get totally lazy because he could go on Johnny Carson knowing that 99% of the people never heard of him. And Johnny Carson would ask him, what are you? And he'd say, I'm a national treasure. Now, he knew he was, and that people would realize it maybe in 100 years, but he knew they didn't know, but he played that irony lazily.
Mm-hmm.
He ran the same joke all the time, played on the people, the fact that he was great, but nobody knew it, and he could make irony about he was a national treasure.
There's also his disconnection from the media, because the media had become more standardized, and you know, that he felt that when he was talking to Miles of the New Musical Express in the 60s and early 70s, he felt they were all part of a new wave of people who were going to change everything, that he felt kinship with them. By then he was lazy with them because he wasn't taking seriously what he could get through in that way, that he was taking, he was worrying about the internal construction of Thingfish, making sure that every word and element of it was satirical of American racism in a way that would both shock and make progressive, you know, he was like balancing these objects he was making, and that's what he was obsessed with. So the media thing, he was almost contemptuous of it, and that led him not to take it bitingly seriously, which maybe was correct.
Right, and to me, he acted out McClellan's prediction that even the greatest philosopher King could not deal with the media onslaught. Even McClellan knew he had it down exactly.
But does McClellan
say? But let me finish.
Yeah.
And yet he knew that even him being correct was not enough. Zappa intuited that. He knew he was obsolete. And he knew that, and he does say in the 80s, the media is all that there is. Now, what are the media? Everybody uses the word. What is it referring to?
Was it McLuhan?
It's been media.
Sorry, was it McLuhan or Zappa who said the media is all there is in the 80s?
Zappa did,
right.
Yeah, it's a rare quote I have him saying. Somebody's asking about the media, and he says, well, the media is all that there is. That's what he said.
Yeah, so well, that's
interesting awareness there. He was realizing the Android meme virtual reality was taking over. But what the heck is media?
When McLuhan's doing it and talking about how eventually it swallows you up, it seems to me he's talking about the obdurate fact that social being defines consciousness. He's talking about how rail as you might to change things, that you haven't changed things unless the whole caboodle has been changed. And therefore, if you are an individual rebel, the chances of you actually leading a revolution are fairly slim, and you're likely to have to post messages in bottles for the future, or lay down particular artworks theories which can contain what you want to say to communicate with people in the future. And this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because we can have a kind of bad instantaneity, which merely is a positivism, which just says what is, and the people who are in charge are the ones we should join or we should go to. But I mean, I think the history of humanity is rather more checkered and complex and interesting than that, that you can be beaten for generations and you can come back again. And, you know, I would be quite satisfied to be a William Blake who suddenly develops new meanings in the 1960s and is discovered by everyone. Who is this guy who criticized religion and believed in free sex long before we did? And it seems quite a satisfactory relationship. It's not necessarily all failure and defeat because Blake wasn't as big as Joshua Reynolds, or was that Simon Reynolds? That looking at the influence you might have as a kind of weave in which you go underneath for a while but you come up again seems to me how it actually works. And, you know, not the defeat that a lot of Philistines, you know, do when they just say, well, what's the point of all this avant-garde-ery which isn't reaching anyone, when the stuff that's reaching everyone is so tiresome that in a generation everyone will have completely forgotten it.
Yeah, the 60s were the retrieval of obscure people and their apotheosis, and then the Android meme wiped that out. Nowadays, in academia, the idea is to find some obscure thing to celebrate and get a paper and get a job on it and have a little niche, and that's why we're in a post-information society. Nobody can do what Blake did anymore. Nobody will be in the future. Just us, the collective, is going to celebrate itself.
Right. Nobody could do what Blake did, or what... I don't quite see that, but then it depends on how different, you think, what you're saying is from what everyone else is saying. And yes. You accuse me of being cantankerous or... was the word
well,
you
let me
using.
Just say that. Let me respond. I was thinking that 2 minutes, 3 minutes ago that the Zappa you liked in the 60s, that's you, Ben. You trying to keep that attitude, that just angry at everything that you thought Zappa was, that you try to carry on that meme, even though it's quite frustrating for you. You don't even know if anybody's listening, and then but you cover it up by saying cancel, but say, oh, it's okay, I get five people. I mean, you're just a massive quadrophenic contradiction, man. I'm not criticizing you. So is everybody else. Mm. You just are honest about it.
Well, so is everybody else. But that is the secret black hole of negativity and criticism, out of which springs anything that can make the wheel turn or anything change. That this negativity that I'm talking about isn't defeat. It's actually this refusal of what everybody else says. Is actually the way in which, the only way in which things move forward. And so it's the essence of all this creativity and productivity that everybody craves, and that there is nothing in the perfect white tooth, smiling, blonde-haired kind of bounciness, you know, that has anything to it can't go anywhere. It's actually the end of the process. It's not the beginning of anything. And so my idea would be to make this negation so extreme that it could find other extremities. It's like a black hole. I mean, it goes inside out once it implodes sufficiently, and if it's sufficiently rigorously negative. So that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for other people to extend this critique with. I'm certainly not looking to bland out on a Hawaiian beach.
Well, that can't be done here.
What, because you go browner?
No, because of the digital environment. Everybody is on their... They don't even notice the beach. I go down the beach, and they're all looking at their cell phones and iPhones and talking. They don't live on the beach. They
right.
got four bodies.
Right,
and
I see.
I'm the only one who takes full advantage of it and release my photos. I don't know if you saw them, the beautiful walk I take every day, because I know how to be indifferent to the other three bodies and enjoy my chemical body. But I also still am now involved with the chemical body. I have no illusions that I'm limited to living in Maui right now. I'm everywhere.
Yeah,
as well as being in Maui.
Yeah,
But the if you got a problem with the white tooth, bouncy blonde or something, then there's all kinds of cultures and radical movements all over the world are against that image.
Well, that's not...
Fundamentalism or terrorism.
Yeah.
What are we looking for? I come back to my original question, how are we going to complete Marx?
Well, we'll complete Marx by not making crass options of what I'm saying. You see, I wasn't talking about... This is your failure to understand negative dialectics. I'm not talking about... Well, I hate the kind of bouncy positivism of successful pop rock, so therefore I want... what was it you were saying? Islamic terrorism? I mean, these sort of blunt choices are ridiculous. I'm saying that bouncy tune actually came from Little Richard, that music actually came from something that was denying or criticising that set of values, and that it's founded on a shaky foundation. It's schismed, just as the whole of capitalism is schismed by its exploitation of labour. And this schism and this contradiction is fundamental to the whole system. That's what's fundamental, not... these, you know, and to thrust that back into, oh, well, I've taken the anti-American way, is pure McCarthyism. You know, I'm amazed at this throwback to the 50s you've suddenly done to me.
Well, I live in all times and places. We're swarming around you. It's called paramedia.
Yeah, but some ideas, Bob, are so bad you do not want to go back to them.
Well, no, I wasn't even meaning that. It's always amazing how you misinterpret me. I was thinking 5 minutes ago that this negativity black hole, you know that there are 10 shows a day on American media that are like that. Crossfire is the archetype. You ever watch Crossfire?
I can't stand those things. You see, I think they're failing to cancel completely. I think they are designed as kind of phony shadows to try and make the absolute flat look in 3D, but they're painted on. I'm talking about living and noticing the actual shadows. I'm talking about coming up from the shadows.
Okay, if we suddenly...
I've got to warn you, you've only got 30 seconds, and I'll let you finish.
Yeah, if we were suddenly the hottest thing going, what would you advocate? Give it to me in 5 seconds. What would you advocate when you were given the podium on Larry King?
Peace, love, and Frank Zappa, man.
Okay.
To which you'd reply, bollocks.
I'd say bollocks.
See you later, Bob.
Okay, thanks, Ben.